I'm Clive Lawton, so those of you who are in the wrong room, you can leave now. Let me remind you what I said this was about, so also it's not what you wanted after all. It's the problem with Pinchas. It says here, Pinchas takes the law into his own hands and is rewarded with a fast-track promotion through the priesthood. But isn't one of the basic laws of human morality, one of the seven laws to the sons of Noah, not to take the law into our own hands, but follow a proper legal system? And if you think this is just a technicality, remember that Rabin's assassin found his inspiration in the story of Pinchas. So what exactly did Pinchas do, and how exactly was he rewarded? We'll explore not just Pinchas, but priesthood too. That's what I'm going to do over the next hour, okay? So, let's just remind ourselves of this strange point in the Torah, okay? And I want to, you know, those of us who are regular shul goers, or those of us who aren't regular shul goers are in much bigger trouble. But those of us who are regular shul goers will experience the Torah in bite-sized chunks, right? Sometimes, if you go to Orthodox shuls, in indigestible chunks, right? But nevertheless, chunks. And weekly chunks. And because we receive the Torah in weekly chunks, we frequently don't put the bits together, right? So last week's was last week, and this week's is this week, and next week is next week. We don't always spot the fact that if you were reading the book through like an Agatha Christie novel, right, the end of one bit would connect to the beginning of the next bit. So let's just remember that we've got three sidrot from last week, yesterday, and next week. We've got Chukat, which if you know anything about Chukat, you'll say, oh, immediately that's the obscure bit about the red heifer and all that stuff. Chukat, right? And then we had yesterday Balak, and everybody go, oh, I know all about that. That's the story of Balaam's ass and the weird thing there. And next week, Pinchas, right? Oh, that's the story about Pinchas. And spearing the, right? Well, it isn't next week. Okay? So, that's what we got. That's the sequence. What is this sequence all about? It's a very strange sequence. Let's just remind ourselves. Most of the Torah, from the minute we arrive in Egypt, right? Most of the Torah, the camera is on the Israelite camp. Okay? Certainly on Moses and the Israelite camp. The Torah follows Moses and where the Israelites are going. Last week, we had Chukat. Yes, it does say about the golden calf stuff. The red heifer stuff. The red heifer's got something to do with golden calf, we won't get into that. But more remarkably, in many ways, last week showed a sudden catastrophic collapse. You had the triumvirate of the leadership of the Jewish people. Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. The previous week, they had one of the most fundamental challenges to their leadership from the Korach and his mates. And they had been seen off, utterly. A few verses later, the people are rebelling again, and Moses again has to demonstrate that Aaron is indeed the chosen high priest. And you've got this little trick with this, everybody has to put a rod into the tent of meeting, and Aaron's one comes out and it's blossomed and produced almonds and so on and so forth, which proves that Aaron is indeed, yes, genuinely the high priest. Right? So now at last we can relax. At the end of Korach, the revolution has been seen off. Aaron and Moses are guaranteed as the leaders of the Israelites. Miriam, their sister, is prophetessing about, and the water's following them because of Miriam. Everything's in place. Next week, Chukat, the entire team has fallen apart. Right? In Chukat, Miriam dies. The water stops. Moses and Aaron are commanded to talk to the rock. They fail. Moses loses his temper in his normal irascible manner. You would not have enjoyed spending time on a relaxed evening with Moses. Right? And there we are. Suddenly, Moses and Aaron told, you're not going into the land. Aaron dies. Moses has a brief time to go. Suddenly, the whole thing's fallen apart. That's the end of Kukat. So what's going to happen to the Israelites? We turn to the Sidra Balak, and suddenly and remarkably, the camera shifts. It's in the most untoward manner. Suddenly, the story turns to the camp of Midian. And there we are with the king of Midian, wondering what to do about the Israelites about to travel through his land. We don't have such an insight into the camp of others in the rest of the Torah. And so the king of Midian determines to invite a prophet of God, Balaam, non-Jewish prophet of God, to curse the Israelites. Balaam says it can't be done, the Israelites are chosen by God. Balak says, I'll offer you big money. Balaam says, well, okay, I'll see what I can do. Gets on his donkey, you know the story, and off he goes, and the donkey, being smarter than Balaam, can see the angel. Balaam's got little dollar signs in his eyes, can't see anything else. And so on. Okay. And so eventually, Balaam ends up blessing the Israelites with some rather strange blessings. Well, there you have it. So the people of Israel are blessed after all. Even a prophet of God can't put this. You know, the Midianites and all their wealth can't stop the Jewish progress. So if you can't enlist God against the Jewish people, who can you enlist against the Jewish people? Well, you know the answer, don't you? The Jewish people. Right? Why don't you just exploit their weaknesses? Send in the women. Right? So what the king of Midian does is in goes the Midianite women, and they start cavorting and flaunting and so on and so forth, and the Israelites are in trouble. Right? They're losing their way seriously. And across the middle of the sort of main courtyard of the Israelite camp flaunt an Israelite prince and a Midianite woman. What does Moses do, the last surviving leader of the great triumvirate? What does he do when he sees this happen and there's a plague and it's catastrophic and something must be done? Nothing. He's stymied. What would he have done in the old days? He would have lost his temper, right? He would have been the one to snatch up the spear and act. He would have called upon God to, you know. But he can't, because he's lost his temper once too often. It was fine to smash the Ten Commandments. It was okay to act furiously. It was all right to argue with God. But this time when he beats the rock, it means he's not entering the land. One more mistake, and what else is going to happen? And what Moses does in the process is vindicate God's decision that Moses is actually blessed, pastors. That Moses, in fact, can no longer act. He knows how to lose his temper, but he doesn't know how any longer to lead these people. They've moved on beyond him. He can't do the right thing. Pinchas, grandson of Aaron, son now of the high priest Eleazar, snatches up a spear and spears these two. You can get some sense of what they were up to by the fact that one spear blow sees them both off. And in so doing, stops the plague, stops the misbehavior, presumably, and puts the Israelites back on the right track. End of yesterday's So the story of Pinchas, that if we know any story of Pinchas, this is the story we know, doesn't belong in the Sidra of Pinchas, which is next week. The story of Pinchas belongs in the Sidra of Balaam. So why is next week called Pinchas? Well, because next week we get the tail end of the Pinchas story. The tail end of the Pinchas story is, as I said in this introductory blurb, Pinchas is promoted with the covenant of peace. He is fast-tracked into the high priesthood. What a reward. What a wonderful, wonderful thing for Pinchas. What do we know about the character of Pinchas? Impetuous, man of action, does things, seizes the moment. What do we know about being high priest? Never again will you be impetuous or a man of action or allowed to seize the moment. What kind of a reward is this for Pinchas? It must be the most grim reward that anybody was ever given. We see Pinchas a little while later on in the next great battle. And there is Pinchas in the battle lines as high priest without a sword. Pinchas is fast-tracked into inactivity. What is it? Kicked upstairs? What do we describe as? Is it such good news to be a high priest? Well, we've already seen this story once before. Because Aaron becomes high priest. What do we know about Aaron? Aaron is incapable of leading the people. He's only given one chance, and that's when Moses goes up the mountain and he leaves things in Aaron's control. And Aaron blows it utterly. People want a golden calf, what could I do? Why does Aaron blow it utterly? Because Aaron is a man of the people. And well, we know this because when Moses was standing there before the burning bush, and God was saying, you've got to go and bring out the Israelites, Moses said, I'm not the right man. I'm slow of speech. I can't do it. And God gets impatient with him. After three separate attempts to kind of turn down the job, God says, you're doing it. And Moses says, but I can't speak. You know the traditional interpretation of this, that he has a stammer. Right? If Moses had a stammer, it would have taken them 42 years to get him. Moses spends the next 40 years talking. In fact, one of the whole books of the Torah is called Devarim, and it's just nothing but Moses' speech. No sign of a stammer anywhere. What was Moses talking about? We know what Moses was talking about by the solution that God offers him. He says, I'm slow of speech. God says, I'll give you Aaron, your brother. Is there any evidence that Aaron can talk at all? He hardly ever says anything. He's one of the great silent men of the Torah. Right? What use is he? Can you imagine Moses and Aaron going into the court of Pharaoh to say, let my people go? In they go. There's Moses striding through the corridors going, I know the way. I know where the throne room is. It's at the end of the corridor. Turn left and straight ahead, and then there's the throne, and we'll tell him. And there's Aaron going, I think we should just come away. Let's not make a fuss. But Aaron's a slave. How's he going to cope? What use is he in the business of telling Pharaoh to let my people go? After all, let's face it, what language is Moses going to say this in? I mean, although we have it in the Torah in Hebrew, the chances are that Moses said it to Pharaoh in Egyptian, in which Moses was no doubt fluent. So when Moses says, I'm slow of speech, I think he means he can't speak Jewish. He doesn't know how to talk to the people. What use is he as a leader of the Israelites when he's not an Israelite, except technically? And God says, I've got a solution for that. You've got a brother who's absolutely an Israelite. He can explain it to them. You talk to Pharaoh, he'll talk to the Jews. Right? And sure enough, that's exactly what Aaron does. Aaron is the one that is of the people. And that's what disables him as a leader. He's great at understanding how the people feel. So when Moses goes up the mountain and he doesn't seem to be coming down, Aaron feels just like everybody else. What do we do now? Crisis, panic. Let's make a golden calf. I know how you feel. So when Moses comes down off the mountain, what to do with Aaron? He is definitely part of the double act. Moses needs him as the other one. Make him high priest. He'll never be able to make a mistake again. He'll never be able to make a choice again. What do we know about Aaron according to the Midrash? Aaron was, you know, the guy that made peace. You know, the camp in the evening, there's Moses communing with God, there's Aaron wandering around, stopping for a cup of coffee, chatting to people. He's of the people, he knows it, right? He's famously the man who likes to keep everybody happy. Moses didn't want to keep everybody happy. Moses wanted to get into the land. That's all he wanted to do. So more than happy to confront and argue and challenge. I know the Midrash tries to soften him up with stuff about, you know, lambs and shepherds and so forth. But basically one doesn't get any sense that Moses likes the Jews. Right? He's impatient with them, he's angry with them, he doesn't understand them. They're a slave people. In fact, the only thing he knows about slaves is you bash them. That's why he's so enthusiastic about bashing things. Once 40 years on, he's got a free people to deal with, and he's supposed to talk. He bashes. God says, I'm sorry, you're not tomorrow's man. Pinchas, on the other hand, grandson of Aaron, has learned how to be a leader. He now has no empathy or relationship with this Israelite prince who's fallen for a Midianite girl. He knows you must act for the future of the people, seizes a spear and spears them. Yigal Amir saw him as an inspiration, because when somebody is betraying the Jewish people, you have to act and kill. But, as it also says in the blurb, that is against the seven laws of the sons of Noah. You presumably know about the seven laws of the sons of Noah. These are more or less the Ten Commandments, less a few. Right? With some strange variations. There are six negative commandments of the seven laws of the sons of Noah, right? And one positive. So six thou shalt not, one thou shalt. It's interesting fact, isn't it? If you go out there and ask the great unwashed what they know about the Jews, the probability is that one of the first things they'll say is they don't eat pork. Which is a slight overgeneralization, perhaps. Nonetheless, you get the gist. I must just tell you, by the way, I've just been in Philadelphia, and I saw on a menu something called a Texas Tommy. Right? Texas Tommy. And it is, in case you ever think to buy a Texas Tommy, it is a kosher hot dog, crispy bacon, and melted cheese. We live in a wonderful world. Anyway, so if you go out there and you say to people, what do you know about the Jews? They will straight away give you a dietary law, right? They know nothing about the Jews, except Jews have funny stuff about food. Right? It is a great surprise to people to stop and think about the fact that the Ten Commandments doesn't have a dietary law in it. That's strange. The foundational document of the Jewish people. No dietary laws. Right? But the seven laws to the sons of Noah does. One of the negatives is that you must not eat meat torn from a living animal. That's a basic definition of civilization as far as the Jews are concerned. It makes lobster a difficult thing to eat. You must not eat meat torn from a living animal. The one positive commandment out of the seven. Oh, and if you're wondering where you're going to find these seven laws for the sons of Noah, don't bother. They are obscurely hidden in amongst the text of the story of Noah. They are teased out by the rabbis at their most creative. Right? And this is not because the rabbis just want to make stuff up. I mean, maybe they did too. But it's because Jews have a doctrine that says not everybody has to be Jewish. And as soon as you say that, you've got one of two options about non-Jews. You either say, so they go to hell, what's my problem? Right? Or you say, so there's got to be some way of being saved without being Jewish. Otherwise, necessarily, you've got to make everybody Jewish if you care about other people. Right? That's the natural corollary, isn't it? If you think the only way of getting to God is to be Jewish, then you've got to make everybody Jewish. Otherwise, it's really selfish and mean, and you're not going to get to God yourself. Alternatively, if you think that you don't have to be Jewish to get to God, then you've got to have some kind of definition as to what constitutes getting to God if you're not Jewish. And so the rabbis necessarily, as part of their generous tribal understanding that being Jewish was for Jews, right, that God very deliberately took us out of Egypt so the Egyptians couldn't overhear the Torah. The fact that the Jews were specifically to be Jews required the necessity of creating a doctrine for determining what constituted a moral non-Jew. And so necessarily too, they go back to the story of Noah, because Noah is the second foundational father of the human race. Right? Adam's a bit before the start. So we come to Noah. And Noah then, the story of Noah, gave them the opportunity to tease out of the text, through quite obscure analysis, seven rules. These seven rules. Right? And the seventh positive law, the mitzvah aseh, the law thou shalt, was thou shalt comply with a proper legal system. Go along with a system of courts. Accept, you know, not take the law into your own hands. And yet Pinchas definitely does. The rabbis are very uneasy about it. You should know that the rabbis are constantly putting brackets around stuff in the Torah, because they are afraid that people will use some of that stuff as eternal moral principle. Right? So, for example, they're very, very clear about the laws, the genocidal wars which were to be carried out.
Oh, Michael, it's Kelly. Have you
no idea where the caretaker might be? Not bad, I got
full. It's a voice from heaven! So rare these days. So, as you know, in the Torah, the Israelites are commanded to go into the land and wipe out this tribe, that tribe, and the other tribe. Right? The rabbis very quickly putting brackets around that. Says that that was then. It doesn't apply now. That's not saying now. We don't have to do that now. Right? And similarly, Pinchas. They want to put brackets around. The way Pinchas behaved was just Pinchas. It's not everything. You can't all do that. You're not allowed to. Pinchas' circumstances were very special. There's not another circumstance like that. Well, as we know, they didn't put firm enough brackets around, allowing somebody like Yigal Amir to take it as a model. But generally speaking, we also know that the Jews have not taken it as a model. That we should act judiciously. We should act collectively. We can't take the law into our own hands. So Pinchas is fast-tracked into the priesthood, which ensures that never again will he wield a sword or a spear. That in future, yes, he is of the family of Aaron, yes, he is the son of Eleazar the high priest, and he will in future perform ritual functions only, including in warfare, where the high priest should be in there on the front line, but not with weapons. So what is it to be a priest? What are priests supposed to do? Now, you may think that this is a rather arcane and irrelevant matter, what priests are supposed to do, until you remember that the foundational mission of the Jewish people is to be a kingdom of priests. And that means to say that all Jews should be priests. So what is it to be a priest? I don't think I really properly understood this until I went to India. I thought that the temple and priests was a bit like shul and rabbis, except a bit bigger, fancier, more marble, something like that. And I never really thought about it. I mean, I knew there were sacrifices in the temple. We don't have that anymore. We've substituted the present. You know, all that stuff. But in essence, I think I had this kind of big picture that priests were like rabbis, sort of. They went about teaching the people, and that's what they did. Right? And they ran the services. And that shuls and temples, the temple was kind of like a very, very big shul with a bit more blood. You know, that was my... I hadn't thought about it very hard. Until I went to India, where, of course, as you know, the predominant religion is Hinduism, and Hinduism has temples and priests. And I suddenly discovered what temples really are. Temples are places you don't go to, even more than shuls. Temples are places you don't go to. The temple's there's priests in it doing all the stuff. Right? They know how to do it. You don't. You can't. They know how to do it. And you walk past it in the comfort of knowing that there are some guys getting on with it. Usually guys. Getting on with it. And occasionally, when you want some help, you know, you want a child, you want somebody to be cured, you want rain, you want, you know, whatever it is, you go along to the temple, you knock on the door, priest comes to the door, says, yes, what do you want? You say, I'd like to have a harvest, please. He says, that's fine, give me a pigeon and a dog, you know, and then he goes off and does some stuff, and you can walk away going, good, good, that's sorted. You don't know how to do it. You can't do it. He knows the tricks. Right? That's how priests work. That's how temples work. And of course, in reflection, that's how the temple in Jerusalem worked. Most people went nowhere near the temple most of the time. Not even three times a year. Because although we know about the three pilgrim festivals, not all the Jews went three times a year on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. I mean, otherwise, who was looking after the shop? Right? The entire Jewish people did not all pour into Jerusalem. And especially once you weren't living in the land of Israel. You were in Rome or somewhere or other. You weren't popping over to Jerusalem three times a year. Mostly you wouldn't have had time to get back. Right? So the temple was going on and everybody was kind of confident that it was being done for you. This is what priests do. Priests become really, really smart at the system of keeping the world God-connected. And in order to keep the world, because most people don't keep the world God-connected. Most people spend their time going about their business, getting on with life. They're busy, they're active, they're trying to keep their children sorted and look after their elderly parents and be nice to their neighbours and stuff. That's all good stuff. They can't be spending their time being God-connected. All that spirituality thing. I'm not very good at spirituality. I don't really get it. Right? But apparently, a lot of people nowadays are very preoccupied with spirituality. Right? Strange in my mind. But anyway, they do. And they all want to have spiritual experiences. Well, it's very difficult, you know, because we travel on the tube. And life just goes on, you know. And spiritual experiences are not the ordinary stuff of ordinary life. In fact, frequently, spiritual experiences are extremely selfish. Right? Extremely selfish. Because it's all about how you're finding yourself. And it's not about that. It's about getting out there, connecting to people, helping other folk. It's very difficult to be spiritual and serve soup. I mean, Jews do it. Because we have a kind of kitchen sink mysticism. Which means to say that somehow or other we're always connecting stuff up. But in essence, right, the Jewish business is being out there somehow. Priest's business is being in. All priests, anywhere in the world, are tied up with arcane stuff designed to keep them clean of the ordinary world. Really complicated business. And by the way, you have to understand that religions across the world tended automatically to go for the priest model. Right? Across the world, religions had a system whereby a proportion of people, a small proportion of people, were separated off to service the technicalities of the religions. Right? They could be hereditary, they could be whatever system. Right? These people would become skilled and capable at these technicalities, so the rest of the people could get on with stuff. Because you needed people to get on with stuff. They're spending all their time trying to service their relationship with God. Who's going to be digging up the potatoes? So you got people out there doing the stuff and reassured them that these people would be doing the other stuff. And periodically they would meet, you would enlist them to help you out or whatever, and you had to give them stuff so that they could keep alive and carry on, because they were supposed to be so unworldly that they weren't digging up potatoes. And so you had to give them some potatoes that you dug up. And that was the system. That was universal, all over the world, worked like that in all kinds of religions. And the Jews are called upon to be a kingdom of priests. Now, what does that mean, then? The Jews are supposed to be priests for the whole world. Because if we're the kingdom of priests, somebody else has to be the other folk. And if every Jew is part of the kingdom of priests, then the other folk, I think we have to assume, is everybody else. Now, this sounds like a very arrogant assertion. Only the Jews have contact with God. We are the ones who will service the relationship with God. The other folk just do ordinary stuff. And so you remember, of course, that Jews value ordinary stuff. There's nothing wrong with ordinary stuff. In fact, ordinary stuff is very necessary. Furthermore, you have to remember the prophets. Although we had priests, we were never very impressed by them. Right? Our priests, as a generality, were never our heroes. We don't have many famous priests. Right? Our hotshot characters are prophets. Prophets come from who knows where. Not necessarily from the tribe of Levi, not from the family of Aaron. Prophets come from who knows where, and they have different points of access to God. They are inspired in different ways. That is, God doesn't just work through priests. He works through other individuals from time to time. By the way, let's remember the story of Bilam, not only Jews. And those prophets frequently have to put the priests right, because the priests often forget what's really important. They get so caught up with the arcane technicalities that they lose sight of what really matters, why they're doing it in the first place. So prophets turn up to put them right. So even if Jews are a kingdom of priests, even if we're doing it all right, that's not to say that there won't be endless characters coming both out of the Jewish people and from out with the Jewish people, putting the Jews right repeatedly about what really matters. That's certainly the way that the system grew within the Jewish people anyway. This, in my mind, goes to explain why Jews have so many odd little pieces of behaviour that we are required to carry out, that we don't think carry any moral force. That is, when you eat kosher, we don't think this makes you a better person. There's no suggestion that somehow the non-Jew who doesn't eat kosher is somehow more morally flawed than the Jew who does. There's no suggestion of that. So what's the advantage or the point of eating kosher? Well, as those of us who do eat kosher will know, it makes you have to stop and think about what you eat all the time. Not just in terms of the modern sensibilities of, you know, how many food miles did this thing do, or is the regime that produced this apple one I can approve of, but rather more to think about your food in the context of your role as part of the kingdom of priests. That is, suddenly you become regularly, if you remember, conscious of your job of relating to God on behalf of the world, of keeping that thing serviced. Of course, many Jews don't, just like many priests probably didn't. They're just so busy getting on with the ritual they can't remember the point of the ritual. But things like Shabbat and things like Kashrut and so on and so forth, regularly punctuating the life of the Jew, is supposed to point the Jew back at the business of being related to God, and ensures that the Jews play their part of being a kingdom of priests, and the other half of it, of course, a holy people. Now, we don't really know what being holy means. We do understand, I think, that it doesn't just mean being somehow pious. It's somehow dedicated to God. Now, we've so lost track of that because we've forgotten what priests do. You should remember that the creation of the shul, we think probably started to emerge in Babylonian times, was fully fledged by the time the Romans came along, right? So a lot of people think that the second temple was destroyed, you know, by the Romans in the year 70, and then suddenly the shul emerged to replace it. But that isn't the case. Shuls, or something like them, ran concurrently with the temple for at least 2 or 3, or possibly 4, maybe even 500 years. Right? People were not all slapping off to the temple. They were probably popping into their local shul. And that egalitarian structure, where the people could get on with being ordinarily Jewish, led to us forgetting what the mandate means to be a kingdom of priests. And we don't really understand that process. By the way, the reason the Christian world is as it is, with its diverse churches, is partly to do with the fact that it was constructed at a time when the temple was being destroyed. And the Christian church, of course, had a memory of both the temple world and the shul world. And therefore it constructed itself over this fault line, creating churches which were somewhat temporary, with priests and hierarchies and altars and quasi-sacrifices, and somewhat shuly, with brothers and egalitarian shared relationships of common societies. And the church muddled on for 1500 years or so, until finally probably the Reformation broke it in two. And that's why you end up with temple-y churches and shuly churches. And more recently, in the 1980s, I was educational consultant to the Hindu temples of the UK. The Hindus in Britain experienced a great crisis, because, generally speaking, Hindus don't have formal structures of elementary, primary education in Hinduism. They don't send their kids to cheder, right? Hindus just expect that you'll pick it up. You'll get it on the street. You'll spend time with grandma. You'll just get it. Over time, you'll get to know what Hinduism is about. You'll just soak it up. But that doesn't happen in Bromley. So what happens then is you've got your temple, you've built your Hindu temple, there's a handful of individuals servicing what's going on there. Periodically, your aunt will turn up and ask the Brahmin to do something for you. But your average teenage Hindu got no reason to go there at all. Never learned how to go there or why to go there, and has no reason to go there. So he is walking down the street trying to soak up Hinduism, and all he's soaking up is rap. So within a few decades of Hindus arriving in serious numbers in Britain, they were worried sick about assimilation. Now you've got to remember, this is a really strange experience for Hindus. There's nearly a billion of them, so they don't normally worry about assimilation. And with Jews, we worry about everybody, you know. Oh no, another one's gone. That's half our numbers, right? You know, the Hindus go, oh no, another million, it's not a problem, right? I must tell you, the Hindu, Indian scale of numbers is just mind-boggling. You know, there are more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan. It's amazing, isn't it? And it's a minority, right? A few years ago, I met an Indian Christian. He was saying to me that life is getting very hard for minorities in India now. I'm not sure that I entirely believe him, but anyway, he was saying that. He was saying with the rise of Hindu nationalism and with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, minorities like Christians and Jews and others and Jainas and so on were being squeezed appallingly. And he said, you know, Jews and Christians and others must stick together, because minorities would get just crushed out of existence. Now, I happen to know that there are about 8,000 or 9,000 Jews left in India, mostly in Delhi, Bombay, Calcutta. About 8,000 or 9,000 Jews. So I said to him, how many Christians are there left in India? Because he was saying, you know, that people are leaving and converting and giving up and dropping it and stuff like this, because it was just so hard to be Christian anymore. So I said, how many Christians are there in India? Numbers are falling and falling. I said, well, even so, you know, how many would you say? People are assimilating, giving up. Well, how many? We're down to about 40 million. I said, we'll stick together. You know the famous story of Golda Meir and Indira Gandhi meeting and discussing things? And Golda Meir and Indira Gandhi said to Golda Meir, so how many Israelis are there? And Golda Meir said, about 6 million. She said, no, I don't mean in India, I mean altogether. So, for Hindus to worry about losing people is a really strange experience for them. It's just kind of the natural being. It's just what you are, you're a Hindu. You don't have to consciously work at it. But now suddenly in diaspora, in real diaspora, because of course Hindus have been in diaspora over the last couple of centuries, but mostly where they've gone someplace, they've created little India. Right? So where they are, they reconstruct a chunk of India. If you've been to Singapore, you'll know, or Saudi will come to that. Little India, right? Or East Africa, right? But here in Britain now, people are scattering, and there are little families dotted about. And they've got lots of little temples, but they don't know what to do with them. So in this program of being educational consultant to the Hindu temples, I taught them to shul up their temples. Right? And you will find Hindus in the country now who talk about shuling up their temples. And what does that mean? It means converting their temples into places that people don't go to, by design, into places that people don't go to by choice. Right? And providing context in which people have diverse reasons to visit this place, because it's rather like a community centre. Right? It's not just a ritual centre for the priests to do ritual. It becomes a community centre. I remember years ago, this is my chance to place drop. Years ago, I was invited to give a lecture at Westminster Abbey. And when I arrived, just right on time, I met the dean at the entrance, and he said, oh good, you're here, that's excellent, right, let's go on. I said, well, just before we go in, can I go to the toilet, please? And he said, ah, toilet. I think probably best if you come with me. He dashed me through Dean's Yard and along a cloister and up some stairs and down it. Finally, his own home. Feel free to use the toilet. Came out, dashed down the cloisters, downstairs, around, come back, and into the attic. And I thought, no wonder Christians run the world. They don't need toilets. Well, Westminster Abbey is built for thousands of people, not one toilet inside. Try plugging in a kettle in Westminster Abbey. You know where it's going. The whole idea, you can't build a shul without a kitchen and a toilet and a bathroom and stuff like that. Right? They're not just ritual centres, they're community centres. It's a completely radical understanding of what people do when they get together and do their religious stuff. Right? And that's not what temples were, and that's not what priests do. The function of priests is to some degree, not to the point where they can't relate at all, but to some degree remain separate from the people and their daily preoccupations. So time and again we come across aspects of Jewish law which seem to be devised, if you take them seriously, to separate Jews from the rest of the world. I think that's absolutely part of this mandate function of being a kingdom of priests. But priests are also required to be constructive in the world, that is to play a role to the benefit of the world. That is, they have to learn somehow how to communicate. There has to be a point of contact. Priests are not supposed to close themselves up in the temple and say, none of you are ever allowed to come here again. Right? We've got to remember that the Jews are the children of Abraham. I mean, we could have been the children of Adam. Yes, I mean, if God had decided to give the Torah to Adam, everybody could have been Jewish, problem solved. Right? Why was Adam not the father of the Jewish people? Because he could resist everything but temptation. Right? The function of the Jews is to stand back from some of the tempting things in the world. The way in which Jewish life is structured. There's all this fabulous stuff out there. You just, I'm afraid, can't have all of it. Not necessarily because it's wrong or bad, but you just need to learn to control yourselves. So Adam is simply not the father of the Jewish people. So it could have been Noah. Why didn't God give Noah the Torah and we could all be the children of Noah? What was Noah's failing? Noah's failing, famously, is that he could only save his own family. Right? There's a marvellous thing in the Zohar. Right? And I don't often quote the Zohar because I don't understand it. But there's a wonderful...
Even I can get the Zohar in this bit.
There's a great bit in the Zohar where Noah comes out of the ark. I have a mental image of this. Right? Comes out of the ark on the side of Mount Ararat. And there, strewn on the hillside and down in the valleys, are all these bloated, dead bodies, animals and people, after the flood. You don't see that in the pop-up book of the Bible, do you? Right? There's a little animals frolicking about, you know. But actually, lots of dead bodies rotting. Right? Noah comes out of the ark and he turns to God and he says to God, "How could you do this?" And God says, "Now you ask?" I mean, well, where was Noah when God was threatening? He was busy building his ark. Right? Didn't he argue? Didn't he challenge? He didn't. He just got in his ark, closed the door, and floated off. And everybody else just had to go hang. There's nothing he could do. Which makes him virtuous in his generation, but makes him a very poor model for the Jews. So who is our father? Abraham. And Abraham's a player. Abraham gets stuck in. Abraham fights. Abraham argues on behalf of people he doesn't even know. Abraham's out there, involved. So too should the Jews be. So too should priests be. But nevertheless, apply to themselves all the functions and structures and systems and rituals that ensure that priests are God intoxicated so the world doesn't need to be so. Now this is a remarkable challenge for the Jewish people, because I said at the beginning that spirituality in my view is often a distraction from being engaged in the world. But a priest, of course, is a servant. A priest is not somebody who is satisfying himself. His entire life is devoted to satisfying the community. He is, in fact, not allowed to make his own private choices, to do what feels right to himself, to follow his own path, to be true to himself or whatever. His function is to serve and service humanity. So that, I think, is what Pinchas was shoved into very quickly, because Pinchas acted according to his own lights. And we just can't have that happen. It might have seemed okay just then. It might have even been necessary just then. But it's the same challenge as we have with all political assassinations. Right? Yeah, of course it would have been great if somebody could have shot Hitler. But doesn't that mean to say that somebody could have shot Churchill? Where do you draw your lines on this? You say, well, Churchill was democratically elected, but, well, he wasn't actually. There was no election that chose Churchill. That became a national government somewhere in the middle of it. So how do you do this? We're called upon to comply with systems of law. And occasionally we recognise that in extremis, there are times when people must act, but we don't want to ennoble the act into an exemplar piece of behaviour. And so Pinchas is quickly wrapped up in a system. And we, as Jews, do not spend time in our cheders teaching our children that they should be like Pinchas. I don't ever recall anybody trying to teach that lesson. So we must be involved in the world. We must be separate from the world. We must be God intoxicated, but preoccupied with servicing humanity. If this all sounds like a paradox, welcome to the world of the Jews. I'm done. We've got about 10 minutes for questions, comments, whatever. Yes?
Yeah, you finished by saying it was a paradox, and I find that interesting because this might sound flippant. Yeah. This might sound flippant, but it's actually a serious question. You were talking about priesthood being looking inwards and spirituality looking inwards, whereas it doesn't mean that you can serve soup, but women do. And I was thinking that if priests had been women, then you might have not the same paradox at all. It might women can multitask and do all these things together.
You see,
to go on from that, does the kingdom of priests include women?
Of course it does, yes, yes, yes. There's no statement at Sinai that this is just directed to the men. The Torah is given to the Jewish people, not to the men. In fact, it's pretty clear the Torah is given to women and children first, but men. We know that the whole transmission of Torah is as much dependent on women as it is. So no, I don't think we can play 20th century games. I was going to say 21st century, but I think they're 20th century. As far as whether, if only women and so on, there's an interesting moment, Jacob. Some of you probably heard me talk about Jacob before. Jacob is clearly a man in touch with his feminine side. Not necessarily to his benefit. As Esau is a man in touch with his masculine side, not necessarily to his benefit. And we see this remarkable moment when Jacob's making soup, right? And in comes Esau and says, "I'm starving." And Jacob, as you would, says, "Sell me your birthright." Right? So what is it that Jacob's thinking about as he's making soup? He's like, "Oh, birthright." Okay, but where's his focus? His focus is not on himself only. It's on some kind of destiny, purpose thing. And I don't think that women, when making soup, are thinking about themselves at all. They are thinking precisely about that bigger business of providing, right? Of doing a job, but providing. So if we're going to caricature or characterize, I'm not quite sure which, women, I would say that their function is precisely what I'm just describing. Which is not, in fact, perhaps, having a lot of time for that private, spiritualized experience thing, but finding ways to satisfy that need in the context of the moments of providing. Right? There's a remarkable tendency on the part of the Jews to break down spiritual moments all the time. Right? I'm very conscious of this. I do periodic things with Christian groups, for example, a model Seder or something like that, right? And somewhere during the course of the model Seder, we've got all these. Well, no, I did a model Seder a few years ago at a Benedictine abbey. I had 200 people at this model Seder, and they set it all up. And they had, when I came in, it was a huge hall, and it was all wonderfully dim with the candles flickering. Stuff, I was all very. I said, "Can we have some lights on here, please? Who could have a Seder in the dark? I mean, it's all madness, right?" Is it? They were trying to create some kind of. And it just seems to me that that, I mean, even when we do silent prayer, we say it out loud. We're just. we're just not very good at that kind of inwardy thing, right? And we're always kind of. Opening it out and sharing it somehow, right? And there's these marvelous moments of breaking the moment, right? Of not allowing us to retreat into privacy. My father passed away a few months ago, right? What is the machinery, right? The machinery, if you want to withdraw into yourself, the machinery says, "I'm sorry, no, this is everybody's business." You go, "No, but it's my dad." "Yeah, I know, but there's a whole stack of people come to see you." Right? This is out there, right? And Judaism is constantly forcing people into relationship. It's a very important thing, right? Forcing people into relationship. One of the reasons, as you probably know, I come from within the Orthodox community. That's a carefully chosen phrase. and therefore my experience is of a male minion. Right? And it seems to me that one of the reasons why the male minion exists is because men are being forced into relationship. Right? And a sense that women don't need that forcing into relationship in the same way. That men are frequently designed to be selfish, self-centered. And the classical forms of Judaism constantly forcing them back into relationship. No, you are responsible. No, you do have to play a role. No, you can't leave it to women. No, you've got to turn up, right? Whereas women, I mean, those of you who go to Orthodox shuls will know that we've designed them wonderfully to be as alienating to women as possible. And yet still women turn up, right? Whereas men, you give them half a chance, they're off. The flakiest bunch in the world, right? So there's something going on there about forcing men into relationship all the time. And I think that's very much a Jewish thing. You have to, you know, you have to be in relationship all the time, and that desire to be. But I've got to have my, you know, I need my own space. I know, but there's other people who need you too. And I don't. And I think women actually, in a generalisation, understand that, get that more quickly when making the soup. I'll allow him to do this, even though he hasn't put his hand up, because he's Joe and he's in charge. Okay. Yes.
Just quickly, Verona. Right. Our minister said yesterday that going back to Balaam, that the ass mastering female in a destructive way, because it was multitasking. It was talking. It was still riding. It could have been a man. It must have been a female.
This is a chamora, right? Chamora. It's very important to remember that a chamora, a teacher, right, is so close to a donkey. I remember that all the time. Yes, sir.
If your thesis is that the Jewish people are chosen to be priests of the world, shouldn't the rest of the world sort of know about that? It doesn't seem like they act that way.
Well, of course they should know about it. We should be doing our job better.
But they didn't even have a role in the choosing, did they?
Look, nobody likes priests. Right? We don't have to get all hung up about that. Nobody likes priests, right? Priests are a drag. We don't understand them. We don't know what they're for. We don't know what they're doing. Nobody likes them, right? They just seem irrelevant, and they're a bit of a burden because you've got to give some of your potatoes to them, right? Nobody likes them, but they're necessary. And I think that's roughly the way people feel about Jews. So we're probably doing it right, actually. Should the world know about it? Yes, they should, and we should be demonstrating that all the time by the manner in which we take responsibility for the world. Now, unfortunately, because, I mean, I don't want to blame the Jews about this, because history has made it very difficult for us, right? But we're right now in the 21st century, it's not difficult for us. Right now, we are at the top of the human tree. Jews are amongst the most privileged people on the planet, right? We can do whatever the hell we like. We're still running on some old, dead stories about how the whole world is against us, right? But we have access to just about whatever we want to do, yeah? And we're shirking our responsibilities regularly by continuing with that old story about, well, it's not so easy and they're all against us and stuff like that. We should be out there. We should be playing. And bless us, there are many Jews who are and who do. I'm very pleased to see that Boris Johnson chose Trevor Chin to head up his fund of, you know, whatever it is. And when you look at the list of what Trevor Chin has done, you see he's led the Great Ormond Street thing and this and that and the other. And we Jews only knew that he was president of the UJIA. Right? He's out there doing all kinds of good stuff. Exemplar Jew. Right? And Jews do play their part. Many Jews do. But we love this little story we keep telling each other about how difficult it is and how nobody wants us and nobody likes us and stuff like that. Right? It's simply not true. We are hugely privileged, have huge amounts of access, can do whatever more or less we like, right? And we're not using it well enough. Yes, sir. I'll just take these last two. I'm very close to time, John.
You spent a considerable time explaining the position of the priests.
Yes.
Would you have felt comfortable making this assessment and explaining the situation with the chief rabbi in the room, and do you think that he would be embarrassed after you told him what you thought of him?
what I thought of him.
Yeah. Well, as a priest, and as a priest position.
Look, first of all, let's be clear. I'm not saying that the rabbis are priests. I'm saying the Jews are priests. Right? Rabbis, as I understand it, are mostly Jews. And therefore they too should do this stuff. As far as the chief rabbi is concerned, let me say, I think he's exemplary in all kinds of ways. Right? Not least the fact that he indeed is out there seeking to upgrade the quality of moral conversation in the world, not least through drawing on Jewish insights in a manner that can be understood by the wider world. You only have to go speak to non-Jews to find out how fabulous the chief rabbi is. The only people who don't rate the chief rabbi are some Jews, right? But generally speaking, out there in the world, the chief rabbi is doing an exemplary job as a Jew in the world, right? And of course he's constrained by all the bizarre politics we construct, right? But I would be entirely unembarrassed about giving this talk in front of the chief rabbi. I might slightly moderate my language, perhaps, but I doubt it. And I don't think he would be bothered by anything I've said either. I would think he'd probably come out going, Clive Lawton's brilliant. Last comment, sir.
Late Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. What the early civilizations wanted from their priests was magic. You know, the ability to control those parts of the world that they couldn't. And today, if we're going to be priests, then we have to take the same relationship to the rest of the world, surely, which is not only the God-fearing stuff, but presumably our ability to handle the technologies. But we're not alone in that, unfortunately. There are lots of other people doing it.
Interestingly enough, I don't get any feeling that the Jews expected their priests to do magic. No, they certainly expected them to construct a relationship with God, which I suppose by itself is some sort of supernatural frame. But they didn't do this stuff about going to the priests to bring rain because there wasn't rain in any particular way. There weren't any formal rituals to do that, right? The priest process was largely about keeping the relationship regularly serviced, in the ordinary ways of human interaction. So yes, indeed, to resolve the issues of guilt and enabling people to carry on behaving, right, and those kinds of things on a personal basis, but otherwise to keep the world running in a manner that said regularly we are in relationship with God and this carries on. We didn't do much of going to priests and saying, can you please fix this moment for us? That wasn't our tendency. Didn't tend to do that. The red heifer? No, the red heifer was a very specific little function. Again, to service the relationship, the ordinary relationship of enabling people to contact God. Right? God is the living God. Just very quickly, red heifers. God is the living God. Right? God is not the God of death. God is the God of life. And therefore, death remains a constant problem for the Jews. How to relate to God if there's death in the world. And therefore, we have a number of strategies in the priest structure to remove us from, cleanse ourselves from, avoid, close off the encounter with death. The red heifer is the most arcane and complicated one of those, but all sorts of other death-related rituals to get people back into healthy, constructive, life-orientated relationship with the living God. But I don't think that's a kind of magic thing. That's something about the psychology of humanity and its relationship with a living God. But anyway, folks, thank you very much indeed for your attention.